Today is Wednesday, October 6th, and you are listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. I am Chinedu for broadcasting from Washington, D.C. Coming up, President Biden hits the road for the infrastructure bill.
With his legislative agenda stalled in Congress, he visited a worker training facility Tuesday in Howell, Michigan, to promote his plans.
Plus, UN slams recruitment of child soldiers by militants in Mozambique.
UNICEF says it is receiving numerous extremely disturbing reports of children being forcefully recruited by the Mozambican militant group Al-Shabaab.
Also, EU summit opens amid tensions with China and Russia. Our top story today is in the U.S. President Joe Biden traveled to Michigan Tuesday to promote his legislative priorities on infrastructure and social spending. The two bills faced a stalemate in the Congress as members of Biden's own Democratic Party wrangle over the size and scope of the package. VOA White House Bureau Chief Patsy Widaskuwara has this report.
Investing in infrastructure and expanding social welfare programs are two key issues President Joe Biden campaigned on. With his legislative agenda stalled in Congress, he visited a worker training facility Tuesday in Howell, Michigan, to promote his plans.
It isn't enough just to invest in our physical infrastructure. We're going to lead the world like we used to. If we're going to do that, we have to also invest in our people like you do right here into this training facility.
Biden pushed key legislative agendas, the $1.2 trillion infrastructure package that has bipartisan support and the $3.5 trillion Build Back Better plan. It's championed by progressives to fund what they call human infrastructure, including education and climate change mitigation.
They don't increase the debt because they're paid for by asking the very wealthy to begin their pay their fair share. As a matter of fact, a significant portion of this plan cuts taxes for working people. And best of all, the cost of these bills in terms of adding to the deficit is zero.
The plans are stuck as lawmakers in Biden's own party disagree on its size and scope. Democratic centrist Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona say the $3.5 trillion package is too expensive and they want it trimmed. Meanwhile, progressives in the House of Representatives threaten to withdraw support for the $1.2 trillion infrastructure proposal unless the larger bill passes. Since the Senate is split 50-50, Democrats cannot afford to lose a single vote. Jason Grumet is the president of the Bipartisan Policy Center.
If those two things fail, the administration's going to have not a whole lot to show for its first year. And it also really calls into question, you know, kind of the core premise of the Biden presidency, which is focused, pragmatic, calm, legislative expert who can get things done. You know, if all of a sudden the Democratic Party spins out of control under his leadership, it really calls that kind of fundamental idea into question.
Biden visited lawmakers in Congress last week, but failed to get them to agree, despite popular support for some of the bill's components. Not only would it address the nation's crumbling infrastructure, but the bill would also provide for universal pre-kindergarten, lower-cost childcare, and paid family leave. Biden's Michigan visit reflects the importance of securing moderate support by the October 31st vote deadline. The legislative deadline for Biden is October 18th, by which date Congress must vote to increase the debt ceiling to avoid potential global economic turbulence caused by the U.S. defaulting on its debt. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News.
The European Union's 27 leaders promised future membership to their six Balkan neighbors on Wednesday, but they brushed aside calls for a 2030 goal. At their summit in Slovenia, EU leaders agreed that Serbia, Montenegro, Bosnia-Herzegovina, North Macedonia, Kosovo, and Albania have a place in the world's largest trading bloc. It will fulfill the criteria on areas from judicial reform to economics. German Chancellor Angela Merkel rejected calls to set a date for the new members, saying that setting a date could put the EU under pressure to add the new members, even if they have not met the right conditions. The summit began Tuesday with the leaders starting to frame a new approach to China. They also discussed how to forge a more forceful European foreign policy after Washington ignored European pleas to extend the pullout from Afghanistan and formed a partnership with Australia and Britain to counter China that excluded France. European Council President Charles Michel said the bloc had to show, quote, collective intelligence, unquote, to shape its response to the developments.
After the recent developments in Afghanistan with China in the Indo-Pacific, it's very clear it's important to develop what I call the collective intelligence of the EU. First, we listen to each other, we listen to different arguments around the table, and we try to cooperate, we try to coordinate. And again, the unity is a very strong European asset.
That's European Council President Charles Michel. Taiwan has asked Australia for help following the increase in recent days of incursions by Chinese jet fighters into Taiwan's air defense identification zone. Phil Mercer reports from Sydney.
China considers Taiwan to be a breakaway province that will someday rejoin the mainland. However, authorities in Taipei consider the island a sovereign state. Like most other countries, Australia doesn't formally recognize Taiwan's self-declared independence. However, there are important bilateral economic and social ties. Taiwan's Foreign Minister Joseph Wu this week urged Australia to increase intelligence sharing and security cooperation as Beijing intensified its military presence in Taiwanese airspace. Australia spokesperson for the Department of Foreign Affairs and Trade said Monday that the resolution of differences over Taiwan and other regional issues must be achieved peacefully, through dialogue and without the threat or use of force or coercion. The statement echoes concern from the US State Department, which also said it was very concerned by Beijing's pressure on Taiwan. Richard McGregor is a senior fellow for East Asia at the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based research and policy organisation. McGregor told the Australian Broadcasting Corporation that Canberra could be drawn into mounting tensions over Taiwan after China sent dozens of fighter jets and bombers into its airspace.
It's psychological pressure, you know, to wear Taiwan down. I mean, China does not want to invade Taiwan. They don't want to fight a war over Taiwan. They want to put enough pressure on Taiwan that eventually Taiwan kind of gives up and agrees to terms, as it were.
Last month, Australia and the United States announced plans to strengthen ties with Taiwan, describing it as a leading democracy and a critical partner for both countries. Due to escalating tensions, such partnership is now critical, McGregor says.
It's going to become a more difficult position for Australia because, of course, if the US decides that it will up its support for Taiwan, it wants help from countries like Australia and Japan.
Australia also signed a new security partnership with the United States and Britain to share defence technologies in what analysts said was an effort to counter the potential threat from China in the Indo-Pacific region. China is Australia's biggest trading partner, but the relationship has become increasingly fraught in recent years because of various geopolitical, diplomatic and trade disputes. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
The World Food Programme warns food insecurity and hunger are rising in northern Ethiopia as conflict in Tigray spills over into neighbouring regions. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The UN Food Agency reports it has completed the first round of food distributions in northern Ethiopia's Amhara and Afar provinces. The operation, which began in mid-August, has reached an estimated 300,000 people affected by the spread of the conflict in Tigray into their territories. However, the World Food Programme reports distributions in Tigray are lagging. It says trucks continue to be stuck in the Afar region and are unable to deliver enough crucial supplies for millions of Tigrayan civilians living under dire conditions. A UN analysis of the severity of food insecurity in June estimates up to 400,000 people in Tigray are on the verge of famine. WFP spokesman Thompson Fury says anecdotal reports from all three conflict-affected regions suggest food shortages are on the rise.
In Afar and Amhara, our teams have seen hundreds of thousands of people displaced from their homes. It is absolutely vital that we have the full cooperation and support of all parties to the conflict so that we can reach all affected populations with urgently needed food assistance before we have a humanitarian catastrophe on our hands across all of northern Ethiopia.
The United Nations reports thousands of people have been killed and millions forcibly displaced from their homes since November, when the conflict between the Ethiopian military and the Tigray People's Liberation Front began. The UN says an estimated 5.2 million people, or 90% of Tigray's population, needs humanitarian aid. Theory says WFP aims to reach nearly 3.5 million people across all three regions in the next round of food distributions. However, he acknowledges several obstacles stand in the way of reaching that goal.
The food pipeline in Tigray remains hand to mouth, with a multitude of issues affecting the free movement of convoys. Additionally, the vast majority of commercial trucks cannot be able to return from Tigray, which has been one of the major impediments to the delivery of cargo, as we have struggled to convene convoys.
Theory notes a total of 637 trucks have managed to reach Tigray, carrying only 11% of the humanitarian aid needed in the region. He says to adequately feed the population, 100 trucks loaded with life-saving supplies must arrive every day into the beleaguered province. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
Indian authorities have suspended internet services and barred political leaders from entering a northern town after 9 people were killed in a deadly escalation of protests against agriculture laws. Officials and farm leaders say 4 farmers died when a car owned by India's junior home minister ran over protesting farmers in a town in Uttar Pradesh state. The junior minister, Ajay Mishra, says his driver and 3 members of the ruling Bharatiya Janata Party who were in the car were then killed by the protesters. A journalist also died during the violence. Police say they've arrested 6 people and filed a criminal complaint against 14 more, including the minister's son. For more, I reached reporter Anjana Patricia on how the death will affect future protest plans by the farmers.
This tragic incident in which 8 people were killed could in fact give fresh momentum to the protesters, who are really angry that the government is not heeding to their demands to scrap 3 market-friendly farm laws that were passed last year. And you know, since these farmers have already lasted out for 10 months protesting on highways through a harsh winter, summer, and even the pandemic, it is widely believed that they are not going to back down easily.
And what has been the government's response?
There is a huge security presence in the area where the tragic incident took place and an uneasy calm. Opposition leaders have been stopped from coming to the area. The government is trying to address the anger that flared following the incident. This is the bloodiest clash since the stir began 10 months ago. It has ordered an investigation, promised monetary compensation to the families of those killed, and filed a case against 13 persons, including a federal minister's son, who has emerged at the heart of this incident, because farmers allege he rammed his car into the protesters as they marched down a road.
In the long term, is the government trying to do anything about farmers' disagreement with the farm policies?
No, unfortunately, talks are completely at an impasse between the farmers and the government. There were some negotiations last year, and the government offered some concessions. Farm leaders, however, are demanding that the laws should be rolled back. They do not want to negotiate at all, or, you know, just to take some concessions. As a result, there is an impasse, and so far we haven't heard from the government, which says there is no question of rolling back the laws.
Does this not come at a political risk for the Prime Minister, who previously said the farmers are one of the staunchest supporters of his party?
Absolutely. It does pose huge political risks for the Prime Minister, especially because we have elections in 5 or 6 crucial states next year. In fact, the incident happened in Uttar Pradesh state, which is also going to the polls in February. It is India's most populous state, a key electoral prize that Prime Minister Narendra Modi's party will want to retain. Now, the farmer stir could impact its electoral prospects in that state, because farmers are a large, you know, they're more than 50% of the population. For some reason, there hasn't been any real effort at resolving the farmer stir.
Are the farmers planning a different kind of protest? Because unfortunately, this one has led to the death of 8 of their members.
What they have done is they have converged on highways around New Delhi. They have actually set up mini settlements there. They've made temporary housing where they are staying. And they say they plan to stay there for as long as it takes. They also hold smaller protests through the country of the kind that was being witnessed yesterday, where farmers were marching down a road. But I think this is the strategy they will follow, because they believe this draws attention to their stir, the blocking of the highways.
That's reporter Anjana Patricia speaking with me from New Delhi. Poor access to screening and medicine contributes to 90% of deaths from cervical cancer, from the overwhelming burden of the disease in African countries. In Nigeria, organizations like the RAISE Foundation are offering free screening in an effort to turn the tide. Francis Maguire with Reuters has more.
Cervical cancer is a curable killer. If caught and managed early, it's treatable. But the World Health Organization warns that poor access to screening and medicine contributes to 90% of deaths. And most of them are in Africa. In Nigeria, some organizations are trying to turn the tide by offering affordable screenings and free treatment. Dr. Amina Abubakar Bello is the founder of Nigeria's RAISE Foundation.
It's a very conservative society. It's a place where you don't talk about such private matters outwardly. So a lot of women would keep those kind of private things to themselves. When they start having symptoms, they will not present on time.
The World Health Organization says all but one of the top 20 countries worldwide with the highest burden of cervical cancer in 2018 were in Africa. For that year, it reported 570,000 cases and 311,000 deaths. Almost all cases are linked to infection through sexual contact, and academic research consortium The Conversation says cervical cancer is Nigeria's second most common form of the disease. Veronica was treated at the RAISE Foundation after she was found to have precancerous conditions.
Don't be scared. Just come. I know it is not easy, but come and do your screening to know whether there's something there or not. If there's something, they will treat you immediately. They will take care of you.
Dr. Bello says Veronica's case underlines the importance of screenings.
So in Veronica's story, you have a good ending. And this is the kind of ending we want others to have.
Late last year, health ministers from the WHO's 190 member states backed a strategy to eliminate cervical cancer. The countries aim to vaccinate 90% of girls under 15 and identify and treat 70% of eligible women.
That's Francis Maguire of Reuters. This is the Voice of America. Assailants have shot and killed three men in India-controlled Kashmir in separate attacks blamed by police of militants fighting against India rule in the disputed region. The first two killings occurred in Kashmir's main city of Srinagar, while the third was in the northern Hajin area. Police are calling the killings, quote, terror incidents, unquote. Germany's environmentalist Greens say they want to negotiate on a new governing coalition under the leadership of outgoing Vice Chancellor Olaf Scholz's central-left Social Democrats, which narrowly won the country's election. The September 26 election left two parties as likely kingmakers. They are the Greens, who finished third, and the business-friendly Free Democrats, who finished fourth. You are listening to International Edition of the Voice of America. I am Chinedu Ofor, broadcasting from Washington, D.C. The UN Children's Fund reports that Islamist insurgents are recruiting young children to fight in northern Mozambique's volatile oil-rich province of Cabo Delgado. We have Lisa Schlein again reporting for VOA from Geneva.
UNICEF says it is receiving numerous extremely disturbing reports of children being forcefully recruited by the Mozambican militant group Al-Shabaab. It says the group, not affiliated with the Somali insurgency of the same name, has reportedly taken both boys and girls from their families and villages. UNICEF notes there is evidence of sexual violence against girls and of young girls being forced into marriage with their abductors. Human Rights Watch recently said the boys, some as young as 12, are being trained in bases across Cabo Delgado and forced to fight alongside adults against government forces. UNICEF spokesman James Elder says there's no accurate count of the number of children that have been recruited, but it is believed to be in the thousands. He says some of the children have been rescued, but none have been released by their militant captors.
The recruitment and use of children by armed groups destroys families and communities. Children are exposed to incomprehensible levels of violence. They lose their families, they lose their safeties, they lose their ability to go to school. And of course, the recruitment and use of children is a grave violation of international law.
Elder says the recruitment of child soldiers has been going on since Al-Shabaab and other armed groups attacked Cabo Delgado in March. The United Nations reports dozens of people were killed and nearly 40,000 people fled to safer areas in the region. 2 weeks ago, Elder says, UNICEF signed an important memorandum of understanding with the Mozambican Defense Forces. The MOU, he says, spells out what the government forces should do when they encounter children with armed groups.
So that training is very, very important so that they know to treat those children as children and as victims and then immediately get the support of organisations like UNICEF, and that can be everything from health to psychosocial support. Those early stages of support for a child who's been recruited, whether as a helper, whether as someone armed, are absolutely critical.
International law states any child associated with an armed group is to be considered as a child and a survivor of violations. Elder says children who have been associated with armed groups are double victims and must be treated as such. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
With less than 1 month to go until the 2021 United Nations Climate Change Conference, world religious leaders are calling for strong action to protect the environment. The leaders gathered at a meeting hosted by the Vatican this week. Sabina Castelfranco reports from Rome.
2 weeks at this year's COP26 summit in Britain, participants will discuss the measures that are needed to avoid what some are calling an unprecedented ecological crisis. The appeal said, "We plead with the international community gathered at COP26 to take speedy, responsible, and shared action to safeguard, restore, and heal our wounded humanity and the home entrusted to our stewardship." It was handed to Alok Sharma, president of COP26 in Glasgow, and to the Italian foreign minister Luigi Di Maio. Sharma spoke with reporters in Rome after the meeting.
"We are at a very dangerous point. The window is closing on tackling climate change and keeping that 1.5 degree critical limit, temperature limit, within reach. But the door is still open. We still have time to act."
40 faith leaders from about 20 countries attended the Vatican gathering. They included the Grand Imam of Egypt's Al-Azhar Mosque, Sheikh Ahmed Al-Tayeb, Patriarch Bartholomew I of Constantinople, the spiritual leader of Orthodox Christians, and the Church of England's Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby. Representatives of several other religions, including Hinduism, Judaism, Sikhism, Taoism, and Zoroastrianism, were also present. Missing from those invited to the conference was the Dalai Lama, the exiled spiritual leader of Tibet's Buddhists, who China does not recognize. The decision to not invite the Dalai Lama reflects the Pope's efforts to improve relations with China. Archbishop Paul Gallagher, Secretary of the Holy See's Relations with States, told the Reuters news agency that the Vatican's relations with Beijing now are difficult, but he noted that the Dalai Lama is well respected by the Pope. Sharma said the Pope and religious representatives who took part in the Vatican meeting cover about 75% of the world's population. Pope Francis has made concern for Earth, which he has described as our common home, a hallmark of his papacy. Sabina Castelfranco for VOA News, Rome.
Two scientists have won the Nobel Prize for Chemistry for finding a new way to build molecules that can be used to make everything from medicines to food flavorings. The Royal Swedish Academy of Sciences said Wednesday that the work of Benjamin List of Germany and Scotland-born David W.C. Macmillan has already had a significant impact on pharmaceutical research and made chemistry, quote, greener, unquote. Making molecules requires linking individual atoms together in a specific arrangement. It is a difficult and slow task. Until beginning of the millennium, chemists had only two methods to speed up the process. That all changed in 2000 when List and Macmillan independently reported that small organic molecules can be used to do the same job as big enzymes and metal catalysts. That's it for our show today. For more in-depth and breaking news 24 hours a day, please visit voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Nadia Taha, and our managing editor, Kate Pound-Dawson, I am Chinedu Ofua in Washington. Thank you so much for listening, and have a great evening.